So imagine buying this state-of-the-art security system for your business. You check all the boxes, right?
Right. You hire the best installers, get the perimeter alarms, the whole nine yards.
Exactly. But then, say, a year later, you find out the manufacturer of that system bought their internal microchips from some discount third-party vendor, and every single one of those chips has a back door built directly into the silicon.
Oh, wow. That is, yeah, that's a nightmare scenario.
It really is. You didn't even know you bought those chips, but now literally anyone who knows the secret knock can just walk right past your multi-million dollar defenses. And today, we are looking at the digital equivalent of that exact nightmare.
Yeah, it's a big one today.
Welcome to our deep dive. So we're pulling from a couple of highly urgent cybersecurity reports detailing a massive, completely unpatched zero-day vulnerability sitting deep inside a foundational piece of the Java ecosystem. And alongside that, we're looking at threat intelligence that shows ransomware syndicates actively hunting for these precise types of, architectural flaws.
Because the software supply chain is, I mean, it's arguably the most volatile battlefield in modern cybersecurity right now.
Right.
When a vulnerability like this surfaces, not in the application you wrote, but in these invisible libraries just bundled beneath it, it forces us to completely reevaluate how we measure our own attack surface. I mean, we're looking at a flaw that turns the very mechanisms designed to make software flexible into an actual weapon.
Which is terrifying. So our mission today is to unpack this specific ticking time bomb. We're going to map out exactly how attackers are bypassing supposedly hardened security layers in Java.
Yep.
We'll examine the conflicting threat intelligence too, because we've got top security vendors and government agencies looking at the exact same internet and seeing completely different realities.
Which is fascinating in itself, honestly.
It really is. And finally, we'll break down the mechanical realities of triage so you can figure out what you actually need to do about it. So
Yep.
let's jump in. The core issue revolves around CVE-2026-16723. This is a critical vulnerability in Alibaba's FastJSON library. Specifically, it's versions 1.2.68 through 1.2.83, and it carries a CDSS score of 9.0.
Which is incredibly high.
Yeah, because it allows for unauthenticated remote code execution. So what does that actually mean in this context?
Well, to understand the gravity of an unauthenticated RCE in a parsing library, we really have to look at what FastJSON actually does for a living.
Okay, let's break that down.
Its entire job is to take text, so JSON data coming in over the network, and deserialize it, meaning it reconstructs that text back into complex Java objects in the application's active memory.
Right, it's translating the data so the app can actually use it.
Exactly. But if an attacker can manipulate that reconstruction process, right, if they can force the application to run arbitrary system commands during that process, they own the server.
Wow.
They don't need credentials, they don't need to log in, they literally just need the application to process their malicious text.
But the sources are very clear that this isn't, it's not a simple point-and-click exploit that just works everywhere, right? Like Alibaba hasn't released a patched 1.x version yet, but the attacker needs a very highly specific environment for this to work.
That's right. The target has to be running a Spring Boot executable FatGer.
Okay, a FatGR.
Yes. Plus, there has to be a network-reachable path feeding the JSON into the parser, and a feature called Safe Mode has to be disabled.
Which is its default state, right? Safe mode is off by default.
Unfortunately, yes. But the really crucial detail from the research is that this exploit works even if a legacy security feature called Autotype is completely disabled.
Wait, really? Because I thought disabling Autotype was the standard advice for FastJSON for years.
It was. Historically, FastJSON used Autotype to automatically determine which Java class to build based on the incoming JSON, and attackers abused that for years, basically forcing FastJSON to build extremely dangerous classes.
Right.
So the industry advice was just turn Autotype off entirely, shut it down.
So what changed?
Well, what Kirill first saw, he's from Firsoft Cybersecurity, what he discovered and responsibly disclosed is this structural bypass that basically renders that Autotype off switch completely irrelevant.
Oh, man.
And worse, the attacker doesn't even need a ClassPath gadget pre-existing on the
Okay,
server.
let's pause and define that real quick because ClassPath gadget is a term that gets thrown around a lot in Java security.
Yeah, it does.
I usually think of a gadget like, say, a burglar who breaks into a house. But instead of bringing their own crowbar, they just, search the homeowner's garage for a hammer to smash the safe. They use the tools already lying around the environment.
That is, yeah, that captures the mechanics perfectly. In standard deserialization attacks, the attacker's payload essentially strings together pieces of code Those are the gadgets that already exist within the application's legitimate library.
Right, they chain them together.
Exactly, chaining them together to execute commands. But with this fast JSON zero day, the burglar isn't looking for your hammer. They have found a way to just bring their own highly specialized safe cracking equipment right through the front door.
Without setting off the metal detectors.
Precisely.
Which I guess brings us to the FATJAR requirement.
Right.
So a Spring Boot FATJAR is essentially this massive Russian nesting doll of software need. Developers take their main application, and instead of leaving dependencies kind of loose on the operating system, they bundle every single library, including FastJSON, inside JR files.
Right.
Which are then packed inside the main executable JR file. So it makes deploying applications super easy.
Well, incredibly easy. It's self-contained.
But why does that nesting doll architecture suddenly make FastJSON vulnerable? I mean, why does bundling it turn the parser into a liability?
It all comes down to how Java reads memory. So standard Java uses things called class loaders to find and load code. Think of a standard class loader as like a local archivist at a library. If you ask for a document, they know exactly how to look on the main shelves.
Right.
But they do not know how to open a locked archive box, look inside another locked box inside of that one, and pull out a file. Standard Java just cannot read jars nested inside of other jars.
Oh, interesting. So how does it work then?
Well, Spring Boot wrote a custom, highly complex class loader to solve exactly this problem. They basically built an archivist specifically trained to navigate those deep, nested Russian dolls.
Ah, I see. So the vulnerability isn't just a FastJSON flaw. It's the specific interaction between FastJSON's parser and Spring Boot's custom archivist.
Yes. The exploit relies entirely on abusing that custom archivist's helpfulness. So when FastJSON processes a malicious JSON request, the attacker includes the specific directive called the @type directive.
Okay, that type.
Normally, @type tells FastJSON what kind of Java object to build, but the attacker manipulates this. They replace the expected object name with a highly crafted, super complex file path that points directly to their malicious code.
So they're essentially handing the archivist a forged requisition form.
That is exactly what they're doing. They pass a path that triggers the Spring Boot custom class loader. And the archivist, because it's just following its unique programming to navigate complex nested paths, it fetches this attacker-controlled bytecode from deep within the nested structure.
Wow.
Or in some variants, it reaches out to fetch it entirely. The archivist basically pulls a toxic document into the main reading room, totally assuming it's just a standard dependency.
Okay, but wait. We established earlier that AutoType is disabled, right?
Right.
So even if the archivist fetches the toxic document, FastJSON is supposed to have, like, a security guard at the door saying, hey, I don't recognize this class. I am not allowed to load unknown types.
You would think so, yeah.
So how does the malicious code bypass that final checkpoint?
Well, this is where Fursaw's research is just brilliant. He traced the exact type resolution path FastJSON uses to make that security decision. And he discovered that when the malicious class is fetched, the attacker embeds a very specific Java annotation within the code itself.
What's the annotation?
It's called @JSONType.
Wait, so they just stick a digital sticky note on the malware that says, hey, I am safe JSON data.
Pretty much.
Why on earth would FastJSON trust a sticky note provided by the incoming file itself? I mean, why wouldn't Alibaba just strip all annotations at the parser level?
Because Java Enterprise architecture is fundamentally built on annotations. If you strip them, you would break massive amounts of legitimate enterprise routing and data binding. The @JSONType annotation is actually a legitimate feature.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's meant to let developers explicitly define how a specific class should be serialized. But in this context, it creates this fatal logic flaw.
How so?
FastJSON's security checker inspects the newly fetched class. It sees the @JSONType annotation, and it interprets it as an explicit developer-authorized trust signal. Oh, no.
It assumes, well, hey, if this class has the @JSONType annotation, it must be part of our expected data model. So the annotation basically acts as a forged VIP pass.
That completely overrides the AutoType restriction.
Completely overrides it. The malicious class is loaded right into memory, and boom, the remote code execution is triggered.
That is an incredibly elegant and totally devastating logic flaw.
It really is.
And the sources point out this isn't just restricted to legacy environments running older Java versions, right? Like, Fursaw verified this attack chain works on Spring Boot 2.x, 3.x, and 4.x.
Yeah.
It spans JDK 8, 11.17, and even JDK 21. But wait, Newer JDKs have really strict restrictions on loading remote code, so how is the attacker bypassing those modern network restrictions?
That is perhaps the most sophisticated part of Firsoft's findings, honestly. For newer JDK environments, the exploit doesn't just rely on the internal FATJAR nesting. It actually utilizes an alternate attack path involving Linux file descriptors.
Okay, walk me through that. First, the attacker forces the application to download a remote malicious JAR file from their own server.
But the newer JDK won't let them execute it directly from that remote source, right?
Correct. It blocks it. But when the file downloads, the Linux kernel temporarily holds it open. On Linux, every single running process has a virtual directory. It's a proxsolved, and that directory lists all the files it currently has open and assigns them a number.
Okay, tracking with you.
So the attacker's payload essentially guesses or brute forces that file descriptor number. They tell the Spring Boot class loader to look at, say, proxsolf FD15.
Oh, wow. So they download the BOM over the network, but then they point the class loader to a local internal Linux system path to actually detonate it.
Exactly.
Tricking Java into thinking it's executing a local trusted file.
It perfectly circumvents the network loading restrictions because, from the JVM's perspective, it is just loading a local system resource. It's a brilliant exploitation of operating system mechanics to bypass runtime environment security.
That is wild.
Now, it is important to note the architectural limitations the sources mention.
Right.
If an organization is deploying standard non-FAT JRs, or if they're running traditional Tomcat or Jetty War deployments, they are unaffected by this specific exploit chain.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah, the vulnerability strictly requires the presence of that Spring Boot custom class loader to resolve those complex nested paths.
Okay, so let's look at this from a developer's perspective for a second, because I can imagine a lot of engineering teams reading these requirements and just assuming they are safe.
Mm.
Like, a common defensive practice when using FastJSON is to bind user input to a fixed class, right?
Yes, very common.
You basically tell the parser, I'm only accepting data that perfectly matches the structure of a user account object. In theory, shouldn't that stop FastJSON from even looking at an attacker's @type directive? But the research explicitly states that fixed class binding does not guarantee safety. How is that possible?
This gets into the messy reality of how complex data structures are actually built in the real world. Binding to a fixed class does restrict the outer layer of the JSON.
Okay.
So if the attacker sends a payload at the root level, FastJSON completely rejects it. The problem arises with nested fields.
Nested fields, okay.
And imagine that user account object has a field for, say, metadata or custom preferences. Developers frequently define those fields using a generic map interface or simply an object.
Because they don't know exactly what unstructured data might need to go in there in the future?
Exactly. They leave a miscellaneous drawer open, basically, because it's way easier than defining every possible item that might ever go inside.
Right.
And that generic drawer disables the safety net. FastJSON checks the outer layer, confirms it looks like a user account, and then it begins recursively parsing the inner fields. When it reaches that generic map or object field, it drops the strict type checking so it can handle the unstructured data.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yep. The attacker simply smuggles their malicious @type payload inside that specific nested field. It's a Trojan horse. The outer shell passes the guards at the gate, and the payload deploys from the inside.
That is just.
Yeah.
It's insidious. So, with a vulnerability this stealthy and an execution method this powerful, the immediate question for everyone listening is, what is the actual blast radius?
Hmm.
Like, are we under attack right now?
That's the million-dollar question.
And this is where the threat intelligence gets really fascinating, because we are looking at an absolute fog of cyber war here. We have top-tier experts analyzing the exact same internet traffic and arriving at completely contradictory conclusions.
The divergence in the telemetry is staggering. I mean,
yeah.
You have major security vendors actively sounding the alarm. ThreatBook published claims on July 22nd that their platform captured in the wild exploitation just 2 days after they added detection signatures.
And Imperva backed that up with their own data, right?
Yeah, they did.
They reported active targeting across financial services, healthcare, computing, retail sectors. They saw heavy activity in the U.S., with smaller volumes in Singapore and Canada.
Yeah, widespread stuff.
They even broke down the tooling. They noted that while some traffic came from browser impersonators, roughly 30% of the malicious requests were generated by automated tools written in Ruby and Go.
Which is key.
Yeah. That indicates scaled programmatic scanning. We are not just talking about script kiddies playing around here.
No, definitely not. Yet, when you look at the CISA ABP assessment, the analysis from the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, They mark the exploitation status for this exact vulnerability as none.
Wait, none?
None. And currently, this FastJSON 0-day is completely absent from CISA's known exploited vulnerabilities catalog, the KEV list.
Okay, how is that even possible? How can Imperva and ThreatBook report automated Ruby and Go tools hitting banks and hospitals while the primary government cybersecurity agency essentially states, nothing to see here?
It comes down to fundamentally different evidentiary standards and the mechanical difference between an exploit attempt and a successful compromise.
Okay, explain that.
Let's analyze ThreatBook's findings closer. While they definitely detected exploit traffic, their own laboratory recreation of the attack was incredibly narrow.
How so?
They only managed to achieve full remote code execution on JDK8 FatJRs. When they pointed the exact same exploit at an embedded Tomcat environment, they couldn't get code execution.
So what happened instead? Did it just fail?
They achieved a server-side request forgery, or an SSRF.
Okay, an SSRF.
Because Tomcat uses a totally different class loader. It's a WBAP class loader rather than Spring's FatJR loader. It couldn't properly navigate that nested Russian doll path we talked about earlier. So Tomcat just treated the attacker's payload as a standard URL and tried to make an outbound network request to fetch it.
So in the Tomcat scenario, the attacker basically knocks on the door, forces the server to look out the window, but never actually gets inside to run commands.
Exactly. And SSRF proves the payload was processed, but it does not give the attacker control of the server. What vendors like Imperva and ThreatBook are seeing in their telemetry is widespread scanning.
I get it.
The Ruby and Go tools are just blindly throwing the at-type payload at millions of IP addresses, hoping to find a server configured with the exact combination of a Spring Boot FatJar, a vulnerable JDK, and exposed FastJSON endpoints.
So the vendors see the malicious JSON crossing the wire. They see the attempt.
Yes, but seeing the attempt is not the same as verifying a breach, and CISA operates on a much, much stricter mandate.
Right, because to get added to the CISA KEV catalog, there usually must be actual forensic proof of a successful network compromise against a real-world target, right?
Exactly. CISA requires hard evidence that the payload successfully executed arbitrary commands, like they need to see that a web shell was dropped or data was exfiltrated, mass automated scanning where 99% of the payloads just fail because the target isn't running a fat jar. That does not meet CISA's threshold for known exploited.
So the vendors are basically reporting that the missiles are in the air, and CISA's refusing to update their list until they can confirm a missile actually struck a target and detonated.
That's a perfect way to put it. It's a really critical distinction for security teams who are trying to prioritize patches. The threat is active, the scanning is absolutely real, but widespread, successful compromise at scale hasn't been definitively proven to government standards just yet.
Which brings us to triage. Because regardless of CISA's current categorization, no organization wants to be the test case that proves the exploit actually works.
Well, nobody wants to be patient zero.
And since Alibaba has explicitly not released a patch for the 1.x branch, what are the mechanical realities of actually defending against this?
Well, the immediate stopgap requires a JVM configuration change. The primary recommendation across all the sources is to enable safe mode. You do that by setting the parameter --d fastjson.parser.safemode equals true.
Okay, so let's look under the hood of safe mode for a second. We know turning off autotype didn't work. How does safe mode mechanically stop that at JSON type annotation bypass?
So safe mode functions at a much lower level than autotype ever did. When safe mode is enabled, it fundamentally alters the parser config logic inside FastJSON. It completely disables the type mapping logic right at the instantiation phase.
Oh, so it just cuts it off at the source.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't matter if the attacker provides a forged requisition form or puts that at JSON type sticky note on it. Safe mode forces the parser to categorically ignore any at type directive in the incoming JSON. It literally strips the library of its ability to dynamically resolve classes entirely.
Wow.
Or, alternatively, organizations can deploy the 1.2.83_non-autotype-restricted build. That build just has this routing permanently severed in the code.
But so it's pretty clear that Alibaba views these as temporary bandages. Like, the official long-term remediation is migrating entirely to FastJSON 2.
Yes. FastJSON 2 is not just a standard update. It is a fundamental architectural rewrite of the library. It abandons those resource probing and annotation-based trust paths that rely on at type. It relies on totally different internal data structures that just aren't susceptible to these specific class loader manipulations.
Okay, but we have to acknowledge the reality of enterprise software development here.
Oh, yeah.
Migrating a core parsing library from version 1 to version 2 across, say, thousands of microservices, that is not a weekend project.
Not even close.
It requires massive code refactoring, huge amounts of regression testing. Migrating to FastJSON 2 is kind of like ripping out the entire foundation of your house and pouring new concrete, whereas enabling safe mode is just, you know, boarding up the specific window where the burglar got in.
It is a massive undertaking, you're right, but relying on just the boarded up window is incredibly dangerous because of the software supply chain nature of this.
Right.
You might apply safe mode to your primary application, sure, but you might miss a forgotten legacy service or maybe a third-party appliance running quietly in your server rack. And to understand why missing even a single instance is catastrophic, we have to look at the second piece of source material we brought today.
Ah, right. The ClimOP ransomware headline.
Yes. So the reports indicate that ClimOP ransomware affiliates are currently targeting internet-exposed PTC Windchill and FlexPLM systems.
And these are massive, enterprise-grade product lifecycle management tools, right?
Huge tools. And the attackers are gaining entry using unauthenticated remote code executions.
The exact same category of vulnerability as our FastJSON Zero Day.
Unauthenticated RCE is the absolute holy grail for modern ransomware syndicates. Historically, ransomware required, you know, phishing an employee or buying access from an initial access broker on the dark web.
It required human interaction.
Right. But if an attacker can find an unauthenticated RCE in a widely deployed enterprise tool like PTC Windchill, they can fully automate their ransomware deployment. They just scan the internet, throw the payload, and encrypt the database in seconds, completely bypassing human interaction.
So even if CISA hasn't confirmed FastJSON exploits yet, the ColdJOT activity proves that highly sophisticated, financially motivated threat actors are actively hunting for these specific architectural flaws in enterprise Java applications right now.
Exactly.
The moment they figure out how to reliably weaponize the FastJSON FatJR exploit at scale, they will just integrate it right into their automated attack chains.
Which means organizations must operate with an assume breach mentality.
Right.
Applying safe mode just isn't enough anymore. The sources mandate active hunting. Security teams need to comb through application logs looking for suspicious at-type values. They need to monitor their JVMs for unexpected outbound network connections because that indicates an SSRF attempt or remote JAR fetch.
So you have to really be watching.
Yeah, they need to look for rogue child processes being spawned by Java, which is the immediate signature of an RCE, and hunt for newly deployed web shells in temporary directories.
You literally have to hunt the hunters.
Yep.
Which brings us to the ultimate takeaway for you, the listener. This entire FastJSON crisis is just a masterclass in the absolute necessity of software supply chain visibility. You might not even realize your organization is running FastJSON.
Most don't.
Right. It might not be a direct dependency your engineers actively chose to include. It could be buried 5 layers deep inside a Spring Boot FatJJ that was provided by a third-party vendor you bought software from 3 years ago.
And if a security team does not have a comprehensive software bill of materials, an SBOM that recursively maps every single transitive dependency running in their environment, they are flying completely blind.
You can't protect what you don't know you have.
Exactly. You cannot defend a perimeter if you don't even know what the walls are made of. So true. Which leaves us with a lingering thought to mull over. We've just spent this deep dive dissecting how a CDSS 9.0 vulnerability can exist in a foundational library deployed across millions of servers globally with no immediate patch available. And we've seen how top cybersecurity agencies and leading vendors can look at the exact same internet and fundamentally disagree on whether the digital house is currently on fire.
Yeah.
So as our digital infrastructure becomes increasingly nested, increasingly complex, and utterly reliant on obscure third-party code acting as the glue for everything else, how much of our global digital economy is currently operating purely on blind faith rather than verifiable structural security?
When a single forged sticky note can bypass a multi-million dollar defense architecture, blind faith is a luxury we can no longer afford.
Well said. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the FastJSON Zero Day. Stay vigilant, audit your dependencies, and we will catch you next time.